From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, a scientist looks at extraterrestrial life. But here's what's happening. Well, there is talk that Al-Qaeda wants to blow up five passenger planes in a Christmas spectacular, perhaps at the United Kingdom level. The threat has been taken so seriously that it came close to leading to an outright ban on all hand luggage, according to an insider, and mobile phones and electronic devices could still be banned from plane cabins with the threat of a 9/11 style coordinated attack on London and other major cities. And they say this could be imminent. The warning comes as a terror strike possibility on the UK is almost, as they say, inevitable, particularly with British jihadists returning from fighting alongside the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. So we'll keep our eyes on that situation. In St. Louis, another sad story, a group of teenagers using hammers to beat a newlywed to death in front of his wife and a friend after they attacked his car early on Sunday morning in an apparently random attack. Zemir Begit, he's a Bosnian, was heading home from a bar at about 1:15 in the morning in St. Louis when a group of teenagers surrounded his car and began banging on it. Well, the 32-year-old stepped out of the vehicle only to be yelled at, set upon with hammers, striking him in the head, the stomach, the face, leaving him fatally injured. Look, I'm going to give you all some advice. Have you ever stopped somewhere at a light and a group of thugs are beating on your car or something? Don't get out of your car and confront them. They probably have weapons, hammers, knives. Just drive away. Call the police. Drive away. Oil prices falling to their lowest level in 5 years, hit by slowing factory activity in China, in Europe, and hammering emerging market stocks and commodity-linked currencies. In Saudi Arabia, they're playing a game. A deep slump in prices might heighten geostrategic turmoil across the Middle East. What Saudi Arabia is doing and the other OPEC states is they are doing an intense political gamble by letting crude oil prices crash. Now they're about $66 a barrel. Their aim is to shake out the weakest shale producers in the United States. They want to kind of break their backs. A deep slump in prices might equally heighten geostrategic turmoil across the broader Middle East and boomerang against the Gulf's petro-sheiks before it inflicts a knockout blow to these U.S. rivals. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Michael Mish Shedlock on this one. They're taking a chance on this, Mish.
A lot of games going on here, George, and it's hard to sort them all out in kind of ways. The U.S. is, Obama wants to get this agreement with Iran to, end the sanctions there. That would cause prices of oil to decline if the Iranian production comes onto the global markets. But you look at members of Congress, they don't want this deal to come through. The war hawks are talking about increasing sanctions on Iran. They don't want any deal here. So that's one factor. But why might Obama want this deal? Well, because declining oil prices, who do they hurt? It hurts Russia. So that's one of the factors at play. But I looked at what happened today, and the sentiment out there on commodities in general is so bad. Everyone is expecting oil to plunge. Everyone's expecting gold to plunge. Everyone's expecting silver to plunge. There was a phenomenal reversal. Gold, from noon Friday, the markets closed early on Friday, from bottom to top today, in one day, going back to noon Friday, rose $78. Silver rose $2.30. Crude up $5 off the low. I'm looking at all of this, and I'm sitting here thinking, sentiment is so negative on all of these commodities, George, especially in the primary metals, gold and silver. I'm thinking the bottom might be in.
All right, Mish, thanks for the advice. We're going to see what kind of a December we're going to have. By the way, Cyber Monday sales, that's where people took to the Internet to buy, shattering records. one of the biggest online shopping days ever. What does that tell you about retail? Oh, my. Gordie Howe, if you grew up in Detroit, you know him. If you grew up listening to hockey and watching hockey, you know him. Gordie Howe is comfortable as he makes a long recovery from two strokes, but the hockey great can't walk and has limited speech. His son, Mark Howe, said his 86-year-old father's vital signs are good, and he's aware of the reasons for his condition. He added that a epidural reduced pain stemming from spinal surgery last summer. The 88-second trailer for Star Wars, The Force Awakens, has amassed more than 40 million YouTube viewers in just 72 hours. In a moment, a conversation with me and you and Howard Bloom. That's right. He's the author of his most recent book, The Muhammad Code, but also The Genius of the Beast, The Lucifer Principle, and The Global Brain. It's just time to pick Howard's brain, and we'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, Howard Bloom with us as we talk about just things happening all over the planet right now. And I wanted to get Howard's perspective. Howard, welcome back. How was Thanksgiving?
Thanks, George. It was wonderful. I went to Buffalo, where the snow was supposed to be 7 feet, 3 inches, and it snowed on the other side of town. The side of town my family lives on didn't have any snow at all, and getting up there was so easy, it was a breeze. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was great. You know, I wanted to talk to you this weekend about these global events, but I figure it would be cheaper to put you on the air than to have to make a long-distance call to you. So here you are.
Right. Well, so you know, there's some positive stuff happening of exactly the kind that you and I usually discuss. I just discovered it a little while ago. For the first time since 2007, a majority of Americans think things are going well in the nation. That's the first time in 7 years. 52% said things are going well. But it's very strange. It's very, very paradoxical because people think things are going well, but at the same time, they don't anticipate a positive political outcome from the new Congress. They imagine that gridlock is a very strong possibility. They really, really want the president, and they really, really want the Congress to make some compromises. So, but this is the first positive news that you and I have been able to discuss of this kind in 7 years.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. I want to first get your take on this Al-Qaeda fear once again, as they're talking about the possibility, and they seem to be very concerned about this, that Al-Qaeda wants to blow up 5 planes. You know, it looks like they're talking about converting cell phones into handmade bombs and stuff. Howard, what the heck is going on?
Well, you know, we humans and most animals have pecking order competitions. It's a competition to see who comes out on top and who doesn't. And in a complex society like chickens in a farmyard, there's a number one animal, a number two animal, a number three animal, a number four animal, and so on down the line. Well, that also applies to individual humans. You see pecking order competitions in any workplace, and it applies to nations, societies, and subcultures. And our president, Barack Obama, made a slight mistake. He believed people who told him that America is the most violent country in the world, and if that America simply steps back from violence, the rate of violence in the world will go down, and that did not turn out to be the truth. So for the first 4 years, until ISIS came along, for the first 5 years, roughly, of the Obama administration, we saw America pulling back from Afghanistan, or at least saying it was about to do that, pulling back from Iraq, although the deal had actually been made with the Iraqis that forced us out of Iraq by George Bush, but Obama welcomed all of this. Well, there's a historian named Ian Morris, and Ian Morris says that in order to have peace in the world, you need what he calls a globocop, one big power willing to enforce peace. So we had a peace in the days of the Romans when they basically bullied everybody else in sight into quietude, into behaving themselves. That was called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. We had another long period of peace under the English in the 19th century, from 1814 to 1871. A nice big chunk of peace because nobody dared go up against the British. And we've had a Pax Americana since World War II. The wars that we've had, they've been terrible, but they've been nothing compared to really, really big wars. when Obama pulled us back, he thought the default state is peace and that America is responsible for violence. No, it's the other way around. The default state is squabbling among the chickens in the farmyard, but when the farmyard chickens that are squabbling with each other are nations, the claws and beaks they use are weapons, and they can do an awful lot of harm. So there's been a scramble for top position in the pecking order. China has been working in a Chinese way. The Chinese plan their strategy 35 years in advance, and they inch toward those strategies so slowly you don't notice them coming. That's part of the Chinese strategy. It goes all the way back to Sun Tzu. And that's what the Chinese have been doing ever since Deng Xiaoping loosened up the economic order around 1980. Now they are the biggest exporting economy in the world by a long shot.
Cyber Monday, Howard, by the way. You talk about China and Alibaba, the Amazon counterpart in China. Cyber Monday shattered records.
Up 11% over last year. Now, the curious thing is that the brick-and-mortar stores were down 8%.
That's what I was just going to ask you. What is this doing to these bricks-and-mortar stores? It's killing them.
It's killing them, but we're moving. We always move to the new. We left the horse and buggy approximately 1905 and began to move into the automobile. It didn't destroy jobs. It created many, many more jobs, and it empowered humans. It gave humans the ability. My dad, when he was a little boy, grew up running to the freight or to the railroad station every time he could and dreaming of getting on those trains. Well, eventually he was capable of owning his own automobile. And then he had all the freedom he had dreamed about when he was a child. That's a radical change in human powers. We take these powers for granted, and we're constantly adding new powers to our lives. And one of those is the power to shop online. It gives us a lot more choice than we previously had, and it alerts us to products that we possibly would never have seen before, and it removes the time we have to spend wandering around in stores. It gives us time for other things, more important things. Dealing with our fellow human beings, texting with other people is a far more important thing to do. Interacting with our fellow human beings, a far more important thing to do than wandering around.
Yeah, but here's the downside. I mean, not only are the bricks and mortar businesses, I think, in trouble because of this retail,
right,
but jobs are too. Did you see where Amazon now has 15, thousands 000. Of robots fulfilling 15, orders?
Right, and it's amazing to see. What they've done is they haven't reduced jobs with this. What they've done is they've reduced the amount of time it takes them to get out an order. So before they installed all these robots, which they just showed to the press on Sunday, yesterday, it took an hour and a half for Amazon to fulfill an order. Now it takes them 13 minutes. So what they're really trying to do is give us same-day delivery, something we have never had in your lifetime and never had in mine. It's a terrific idea, but again, robots are a problem. Every form of industrialization or every new form of technology is a problem because it adds new powers, but it displaces old jobs, and we don't see clearly enough into the future to be able to see what kinds of new jobs it's going to create. When looms came in, automatic looms, and the beginning of the 19th century, around 1800, you know that the people who had hand loomed at home went crazy because they were going to be put out of jobs, and they started putting wooden shoes into the machinery to destroy the machinery. Well, those wooden shoes were called sabots, so what they were doing was called being a saboteur, putting your wooden shoe in the machinery. Well, the new looms opened factory jobs that to us look terrible now, absolutely like the worst jobs in the world. But at the time, those jobs were paradise compared to working on a farm and spending 7 months of the year in the darkness of winter and snowed in with nothing to do. I mean, there were no television sets. To be able to go to a factory and earn a wage was paradise at that point. So the saboteurs failed to see that there were new jobs right around the corner and more jobs than ever before, and they were better jobs. And today's jobs are even better than that. Although, you know, I saw a piece, and it was sent to me by your producer and mine, Lisa Lyons, on a woman who worked as one of those order fulfillment people at Amazon. It was a nightmare. She felt totally depersonalized. She was utterly isolated and alone. She was constantly was aware of the fact that she was being surveyed or watched by company cameras. It was really, really awful. But that's a matter of Jeff Bezos not knowing how best to take advantage of his human capital. At Google, they do just the opposite. At Google, they tell you, you will take one day a week to do nothing but what you think is the dream project of your life. That's when you mobilize human capital, when you latch onto the human spirit and you let it soar.
Amazing things. Look, I want to get your take on a couple other things here, and then we'll get into some other fascinating areas, Howard. You're just a delight, by the way. It's just...
Well, thanks, George. I thought I had utterly alienated you last week when we talked, so I'm delighted.
No, not at all. We don't have to agree on everything, you know.
Well, no, I went off on a tangent. We were talking about Ferguson, but I had prepared the whole world and saw how it fit into this common pattern of pecking orders.
Yeah, you were a little hot under the collar on that one.
Oh, I was. Yeah, I was going. I had been studying the globe for you.
Well, lots going on these days. Look, I want to get your take on what you think the future is going to hold for people's insides, their souls. I mean,
well,
they just
we have been overlooking the human soul.
Yes, we have.
They haven't been overlooking at ISIS. We wonder why recruits go to ISIS. Well, you know that line from the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, freedom, and brotherhood. They get brotherhood. They get bonded, warm relationships in ISIS. Every day they wake up knowing that they have a purpose in life and knowing their purpose for that individual day. And most important, every day they wake up knowing that they are a part of something higher than themselves, far bigger than themselves. Those are the basics of human meaning. And we in the West have forgotten about the importance of human meaning. When Hillary Clinton talks about international affairs, she's a very bright woman. But when she talks about international affairs, she talks as if the highest goal for all humans on the face of planet Earth is to have a good job. No, I'm sorry. You need that sense of meaning, that sense of purpose, that sense of contributing to something higher than yourself. So I did something really dangerous. Back at the beginning, it was 2002 or 2003, after 9/11, and when WorldCom and all the big companies were crashing, I wanted to write a book that was called The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism, basically to write an anthem to show how human spirit is, of all things, this is going to sound crazy, but the human spirit is the most essential thing in the capitalist system. Sounds really weird, but think of it this way. When you go on the air, you know that you have to uplift the souls of 10 million people in order to earn your job, your keep for the next day, in order to make your career and advance it. And if you can lift the spirits of 15 million people, you do even better. To earn a dollar in capitalism, you have to lift somebody somehow. You have to empower them. You have to feed them. You have to nourish them. But more important, you have to lift them in ways they've never quite been lifted before. That's what a Fitbit does when it arrives on the scene. That's what a smartwatch does when it integrates with your cell phone. That's what, once upon a time, 10 years ago, in the dim and distant days of antique technology, that's what all of the tiny little music players that Steve Jobs was making did. So the mandate of capitalism is secular messiahship. It is providing secular salvation for your fellow human beings. We don't know that. And we don't know what we're achieving for each other. We're achieving miracles for each other. We've talked about this several times, but I'll go down the list again. The poorest paid worker today earns what an entire tenement full of the poorest paid workers earned in 1850, 150 years ago. The average dummy in the average school has an IQ that rates at marginal genius according to IQ's tests from 1900. In other words, the average IQ has gone up by 35 points. The average height has gone up by 4 inches. The amount of peace in the world has gone up by a factor of 10. That's absolutely astonishing. And these are just a few of the things we've achieved. But if you achieve these things and you don't know it and you don't have leaders in your society who can preach your achievements and who can inspire you to make even greater achievements in the future, you wander around thinking that you've achieved nothing. We haven't achieved nothing. We've achieved incredible things. We have to know it. We have to not rest on our laurels. We have to take criticism seriously, and we have to try to continually meet the challenge of outdoing what our grandparents have done for us with additional longevity, an extra 40 years of life we've added in the last 150 years. So besting those things, adding another 35 points to the average IQ, adding another 4 inches to the average human height, septupling the human wage, increasing the peace in the world by a factor of 10 again, that's our responsibility.
That'll work. Howard, we're coming back for more and calls with you next. And welcome back to Coast. Howard Bloom with us, of course, the human mind, and we'll take your calls this remaining half hour with Howard. Howard, your take on social networking. I've seen it work. I've seen it create some issues. But what's your take on it?
I think it's brilliant. We humans are built biologically to respond to others, to our contact with others. When we lose contact with others, our immune system goes into a nosedive, and our cognitive system goes into a nosedive. We go into a kind of gray fog. And with social networking, it can take away from our face-to-face communications if we let it. If we are rude and we sit there at the dinner table playing with our cell phone, or we lay there in bed with our wife playing with the cell phone, but only rude people do that kind of thing. For the majority of us, it opens us up to human contact in moments and in places when we've had no opportunity for contact before. It lets us make contact with people 1,000 miles away, 2,000 miles away, 10,000 miles away, who share our interests. I think it's absolutely marvelous, but like any tool, you know, a hammer can be used to kill, or a hammer can be used to build a house. And it's very important to know how to use the tool as a tool of connection, not a tool that breaks our connections.
Well, you know, I had thought when I saw what happened with the Arab Spring that it helped, you know, get people together to protest and do what they had to do against oppression. And then, of course, here in the Ferguson area, I do believe that social networking is being used exactly the same way that they did for the Arab Spring, trying to get people together. Because I've never seen so many people get together so quickly at certain areas.
Well, so it helps when there's a legitimate protest, but then there's the illegitimate protest, the violence. Now, in looking into the people behind the groups that are running the Ferguson protests, I haven't been able to find anything. They don't post who they are. They don't post what they're all about. They're very secretive. But as long as the stuff is used for positive protest, it's good. Of course, what you see with ISIS is that ISIS is using it to recruit people to blow themselves up in marketplaces, killing 30 or 40 other people. Look, if people want to blow themselves up, let them go off into the desert and blow themselves up. That's their free right.
That's right. But let them go up to Allah.
Yeah, they cannot do it to kill innocent people who are simply going to the market to buy bread. That is absolutely appalling. And so you can, again, it's the hammer can be used to kill or a hammer can be used to build a house proposition. One of the first uses of social media was before any of us recognized social media. It was when we only had texting. It was back around 2005 or something like that. The Filipinos had voted in an actor as the head of their government, and it looked to them like he was spending all of their money carousing and fooling around with girls and wasn't really paying any attention to his job. So they got together through flash mobs. They got together through texting. And through texting, they overthrew this president. Well, and they brought in a better one. Well, that's a positive use of this tool.
Sure.
So the trick is to stress the positive and to discourage the negatives wherever possible. I know that, George, if I come up with an idea and I want to test it, and I'm afraid that it's really maybe other people won't understand what it's all about, I put it up on Facebook, and I have responses within 15 seconds.
Oh, I know. It's instant. Information is instant. You know, in the old days, we used to rely on breaking radio news or a cut-in from Walter Cronkite on television. Nowadays, it's there. It's on the Internet. It's beamed to your smartphone. We get it instantly. There's a lot of positives there.
It's not just that it's instant. I don't know if you use this, but I use Google Sidebar. Well, that means that no matter what I'm doing, and you know when I'm working on a book, I have to really, really concentrate. But no matter what I'm doing, even if I'm writing a book, there's this little crawl about an inch and a half wide on the far right-hand side of my screen, and it's giving me the headlines as they break. So it's terrific. It lets you, you know, you, when you were a news director, had to have a sense of the pace of the news. You sort of had to breathe its rhythms, which you could do when you had news services feeding into you on a constant basis. Well, now any of us can do that. All of us can do that. It's terrific.
All right, let's take some calls here for you, Howard. Let's go first of all to California. Linda is west of the Rockies. Linda, you're on with Howard Bloom. Go ahead. Good morning. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, George. Say,
sure.
Howard.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. Hi, Howard. First time on. Didn't intend really to speak with you. Just wanted to call in and talk with somebody else. But anyway, I'm on, so say, Howard.
You're stuck with me, poor baby.
Yeah, right. Take it easy on me. And I'll try to take it easy on you. But here's what I've written. Say, Howard, along with your all your happy talk with near-religious fervor about computers, cell phones, and technology, I'd like to know what you think about the public health consequences of exposure to the microwave radiation that is an assault on our immune systems and is the cause of the epidemic of brain cancers and many other cancers that we now have, so much so that we've got, you know, like 1 in 3 people will now get cancer sometime in their lifetime.
All right, good question. And you know, Howard, whenever I microwave anything, primarily to defrost something,
right,
I stand away from this thing.
Well,
I, you know, I go way off to the side.
Here's the bottom line. In 1922, we started saturating our atmosphere with radio waves. And you would think that making that kind of radical change in the surroundings, the environment in which we all swim like fish in an aquarium, that we would have done incredibly awful things to our health. But since 1922, we've increased in longevity about 20 years. And we added to that initial batch, that heavy, you know, we registered 600 radio stations in 1922. And then the stations kept growing exponentially. Then, around 1950, we added television and added even more of these waves. In the 1990s, we went with cell phones, and we added even more of those waves. Wherever there are cell phone towers, there are electromagnetic waves pulsing through you all the time from those towers. It isn't just from your phone. And yet, people have been getting healthier and healthier and living longer and longer. So the reason that we've had an increase in cancers is because we didn't used to live this long. The average in 1850, we were dying at 38 years. 38 years old is when we were dying.
Yeah.
Only very wealthy people managed to live into their 70s. Well, today, living into their 70s is not that uncommon. At Thanksgiving, I was with my aunt's boyfriend. My aunt is about 84, and her boyfriend is 90. He looks like an athlete. It's amazing. So cancers are increasing because we're living in sort of zones that we're exploring of age that didn't used to be available to us before. Linda, I'm 71 years old. I did 450 push-ups this morning, and I was embarrassed because...
How many? Wait a minute. Wait, you did 450?
Without stopping, but 2 months ago I did 720 without stopping, and I'm 71 years old. That would have been impossible 30 years ago or 40 years ago. My grandparents died before they got anywhere near my age. So there are vast new frontiers of longevity that we're opening, and radio waves and television waves and electromagnetic waves have not decreased our age and decreased our health. If anything, they've increased our health.
How long did it take you to do 450 push-ups?
It takes about 8 minutes. It takes a lot of discipline because you don't want to do it, and you have to make yourself do it every single day, even though you don't want to do it. But it's a great thing to do because when you are 71 years old, a little voice in your head, when you wake up in the morning, says you're getting old, and your brain starts to collect every little ache and pain you've got. That's called a perceptual frame. Well, if you get down on the floor and you do anything over 30 push-ups, your body is saying, sorry, that perceptual frame is totally invalid. You are far, far younger than you think, and you march through the rest of the day with a perceptual frame that orients you around your strengths, not around your weaknesses. It's a little miracle.
Well, good for you, especially coming from a guy who was bedridden for how many years?
15 years, and for 5 years, too weak to
Amazing.
Talk, and too weak to have another person in the room.
To so, Chicago we go. Kay, you're on with Howard Bloom. Go ahead, Kay.
Hey, George. Howard, how are you?
Hi, Jay. How are you?
You know, we're trying to stay warm. I was listening to, of course, your diatribe on ISIS and our position as a nation that should become the world's policeman. And I sat back your fight. The way we've been doing things foreign policy-wise in the last decade, if we became the world's policeman, I'd ask NASA if I could go on the first Mars trip. I don't believe that we have the capability, whether it's in the Republican hands or in the Democratic hands, to do anything of the such any longer. And to prove that, we have ISIS. ISIS was a partial creation of us.
Yep.
Running around with silly foreign policy, both Republican and Democrats, arming people we had no idea to. And when I see something like that, Howard, I have to totally disagree with any notation of us becoming a world's policeman when we ourselves need to grow up.
Well, the history of things basically goes like this. When the world has had one dominant power, I mentioned Rome and I mentioned Britain, the amount of peace in the world has gone way up. The number of wars, I mean really, really appalling wars, has gone way, way down. And that's why I think when President Obama, who I voted for twice, drew a red line in Syria and then failed to enforce it, he basically advertised to Vladimir Putin that, oh, the path is open. You can take over as a top dog now. And Putin responded to it by, in September, he had Russian strategic bombers in the Labrador Sea near Canada simulating a cruise missile strike on the United States. And that's just one of about 40 of these bold military infractions that the Russians have pulled in an attempt to demonstrate they're big boys and we are not. You know, Forbes magazine put Vladimir Putin on the cover 2 years in a row as the world's most powerful man. And Putin has taken that very seriously. So he's just come from a visit in Turkey. Now, Turkey is a NATO country. And Putin just made a big deal for an oil pipeline or a gas pipeline to go through Turkey and made a deal to build nuclear plants in Turkey. Well, those nuclear plants could easily end up producing at some point the raw materials for nuclear weapons. That's nuclear proliferation. Somebody's got to take a top dog position. That's true in a wolf pack. That's true in a batch of chickens. That's true even in lizards or even in lobsters. And the remarkable thing, if you go back to the animal behavior research on chickens and lobsters and lizards, you discover that once a top dog has been established, there's peace in the barnyard. Or once a top chicken has been established, there's peace in the barnyard. But in periods of instability, when the top dog has been removed, or when a new chicken comes into the pack and doesn't yet have its position established, that's when all hell breaks loose. So, unfortunately, as immature as we are, as little as we understand things, as big as our mistakes are, and they are big when we assume that by opening a power vacuum in the Middle East, democracy would come rushing in. That was an assumption, a wrong assumption, made by two presidents in a row, George Bush and Barack Obama. We were wrong. We made a mistake. But power vacuums lead to chaos, and the form of chaos you really do not ever want to see again is a world war. So in order to keep that from happening, unfortunately, all the research on animal behavior, all of the research on history indicates you need somebody willing to take on the role of global cop.
In your opinion, Howard, is the world in total chaos and potential collapse?
Not at all. We are on our way to things that you wouldn't believe. I mean, even just wearables and the Fitbit, and right now there's an Xbox-related wearable that's about to come out, and smart watches and stuff like this. All of this gives us new powers. Once upon a time, you know, I work with the 11th president of India. We work on harvesting solar power in space and bringing it down to Earth. And I called my negotiating partner, or I emailed him, or whatever. I know it was Skype in India. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning his time, and that's when we normally start talking. And he said, I can't talk today. My sister just came into town. Okay, now, the guy I'm talking to was 74 years old. His sister was 78. She had just flown in from another city. She'd sat down in his living room. She'd taken out her smartphone. This is in India, where children were dying 20 years ago or 40 years ago of starvation. And he said that she made more phone calls in half an hour than he makes in a month. Well, what do you think was keeping her so healthy at the age of 78, at an age when she would have been dead a generation ago? All those social contacts, all that social contact ups the level of the immune system. It does stuff even drugs cannot do. It increases the speed with which your brain operates. So things are changing in ways that are so radically different than they were just 20 to 40 years ago that it's ridiculous. And now it's your job and my job to be a part of that change, and Kay's job and Linda's job, all of our job, to not just be a part of that change, but to advance that change.
Let's go to Donovan in Greenville, Ohio, first-time caller. We'll squeeze you in. Donovan, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. Hi, Donovan. How are you?
Just fine. Hey, listen, I wanted to basically get your take on Obama and the CIA creating ISIS, and the fact that I feel that if they did create them, why aren't we there trying to stop them? I know that Obama sent some troops over there to kind of back them up. You know, I feel like we're building something that we may not be able to tackle.
All right, let's get your take on that. Howard, only have a couple minutes left.
Okay, we did create Al-Qaeda. We played a heavy role in that. But there is one man and one man only who is responsible for creating ISIS. He laid out the pattern for everything ISIS does. His name is Mohammed. And he laid out this pattern from 624 A.D. when he invented jihad to 628 A.D. when he invented the idea that jihad should conquer the entire world, and on to his death in 632 A.D. Within 100 years of his death, Islam had taken an empire 11 times the size of the conquests of Alexander the Great, 5 times the size of the Roman Empire, and 7 times the size of the United States, and it had done all of this at a period of time when no CIA existed. All ISIS needs is the example of Mohammed, and that is their primary motivator. The CIA had nothing for all practical purposes. Yes, we armed them by arming a bunch of buffoons, a totally corrupt army.
We wanted them to get Assad out of Syria, too, didn't we?
That's a questionable issue. It was really Saudi Arabia, who at that point was much closer to us. And you know that those forces that are allegedly the forces of civil war, the anti-Assad forces, the people backing them are Saudi Arabia and the Sunni forces in the Middle East. This is a proxy war. It's Iran, which is Shiite, versus Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, and yep. It's being fought out in Syria to the great detriment of the Saudis who've sacrificed, or the Syrians, rather, who have sacrificed 190,000 lives going on 200,000 in the name of this proxy war, this puppet war. But our CIA did not create ISIS, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I think we were part of it somehow. Howard, you know that?
Well, we feed into everything, George, because we have our hands in just about everything. But again, it's the example of Mohammed, and what Islam has done in the past has been utterly beyond belief. They are the greatest imperialist force in the history of the world. And so for them to return to an imperialist pattern, or an imperialist and colonialist pattern, is not at all surprising.
Howard Bloom, thank you again so much. Howard's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I shall be back as we take a look at astrobiology, ETs, and space.